So this is the Dharma talk for the August 2018 session. And what I would like to talk about this morning is teachings from Zen Master Hakuin, who I can say a little bit about him, but I have this book which is The Essential Teachings of Zen Master Hakuin, and it's beautiful. And there's so many good things in here, but maybe for people who don't know who Hakuin was, I'll give just a little bit of background. So Hakuin is a major figure in Japanese Rinzai Zen. So Rinzai is a little bit like associated to Soto Zen. It's not quite exactly the same as our school. It's not our lineage, but anyway, it's related. Has common ancestors. So Dogen is a common ancestor of both Rinzai and Soto Zen. But Hakuin was a country priest in a tiny rural temple at the foot of Mount Fuji. And he lived from 1685 to 1768. So not quite in the ancient past, but still a long time ago. He's known for almost single-handedly reforming and revitalizing Rinzai Zen at that time, which had been in a state of some spiritual lethargy. He had hundreds of students, and there are, we know of 50 Dharma heirs. That's a lot. So Dharma heirs, people that he gave Dharma transmission to, we know of 50, and it's said that there were probably at least 50 more who were unknown, so he probably had over 100 Dharma heirs. In addition to being well known as a Zen teacher, and partly because of the way he revitalized Zen, and also partly because he wrote stuff, so we have a record of his teaching. But in addition to that, he was also very well known as a painter and calligrapher. So some of that art, like the art, I believe this art on the front of the book is from him. And it's someone, it's like you hear about the koan about when you're at the top of a 100-foot pole, what can you do? Take one more step. And this is like a 100-foot pole, except it's like, it's more like a branch on its side, and there's a little monk that's sort of crawling out to the edge, to the end of the branch. So another thing to know about Hakuin is that he was known to be very fierce with his students, very no-nonsense. And at the same time, he was also well known for being very kind and warm-hearted with the people in the village. So it wasn't like only one thing that he did. And as I said, he's not directly in our lineage because it's, you know, Rinzai Zen branched from after Dogen, Rinzai and Soto branched off. But we owe him a great debt for keeping Zen alive. So he revitalized Zen really overall, not just in his lineage. So I'd like to share a few excerpts from one of his talks that he gave, one of his informal talks. And that talk in this book is titled The Difficulty of Repaying the Debt to the Buddhas and Ancestors. So feeling like we owe him a debt of gratitude, and then now he's talking about in the past the debt that is owed. And you know, when we talk about owing a debt to this, our spiritual ancestors, it's not quite the same as a money debt. So if you owe a spiritual debt, if you feel that, then your solution, you know, how you pay someone back is to practice. So that's what he's talking about, the difficulty of repaying the debt to the Buddhas and ancestors is practicing, and practicing is difficult, can be difficult. So anyway, here's one thing that he said. Buddha means one who is awakened. Once you have awakened, your own mind is itself Buddha. By seeking outside yourself for a Buddha, You set yourself forward as a foolish, misguided person. Let's say you are a person who wants to catch a fish. You must start by looking in the water, because fish live in the water and are not found apart from it. If you want to find Buddha, you must look into your own mind, because it is there and nowhere else that Buddha exists. So by mind here, this does not mean intellect. So this is not the calculating, figuring out mind. It's not separate from that mind either. But sometimes we kind of have a narrow view of what it means when we say, look into your own mind. So when Hakuin says this, he's talking about big mind that includes everything. So it even includes the body, feelings, dharmas. That's the big mind. So next he asks a question, or maybe someone asked him a question. It's not clear from the text, but next it says, question. In that case, what can I do to become awakened to my own mind? So that's pretty good. I mean, that's what you would do next if someone said to you, okay, if you want to find Buddha, you must look into your own mind. And then the question is, okay, what can I do to become awakened to my own mind? So this is where we begin. We begin with something like, what is a burning question for us? So that might be your burning question, or you might have a different burning question. Like, who am I? Why am I here? What is really going on? Whatever is your burning question, that's where you start. And when this person who's asking Hakuin, or maybe it's Hakuin asking himself, like I said, it's a little unclear. So there's this question. In that case, what can I do to become awakened to my own mind? Then Hakuin follows it up with, what is that which asks such a question? So the person says, how do I become awakened to my own mind? And Hakuin says, what is that which asks such a question? Is it your mind? Is it your original nature? Is it some kind of spirit or demon? Is it blue, yellow, red, or white? So do you see what's happening here? The student asks a question, what should I do? And the teacher says, okay, let's back up. Who is this I that wants to know what to do? In other words, Hakuin is saying, please study the self. But how do we do that? Where to begin? Where can we begin? So last month I was on a 9-day solo retreat. I practiced with the Sutra on the Full Awareness of Breathing, the Anapanasati Sutta. And this is a way of practicing with body, feelings, mind, and wisdom. So there were a lot of wonderful things about having a chance to spend that much time in solitude and meditation. But one of the things was, I would say, an insight, but it's not like something that I didn't know already, but maybe more like I just really knew it. So one big insight for me that arose during that time was how the mind is not separate from the body. And wisdom is not separate from the body. And it's not separate from feelings and mind. So wisdom includes the body, feelings, and mind. They all interpenetrate. So in this sutra on the Full Awareness of Breathing, it's from the Buddha, and he taught to be aware of your breath. So starting with breathing in, I know I'm breathing in a long breath, breathing out, I know I'm breathing out a long breath, or if it's short, I know it's short. Or so like knowing what's going on with my breath, and then knowing what's going on in my body. So there's a whole thing about body, breath and body. But then each thing is the breath. So it moves into next into feelings. I'm not going to, I could give a whole talk on this sutra, but I'm not going to. Just to say, the thing that's interesting is each thing is the breath. So the breath, of course, happens in the body. So if I'm aware of my breath while I'm aware of my feelings, while I'm aware of my mind, while I'm aware of wisdom, I see how the body is in each of those, and also how they build on one to the other, so they're not separate. So I really felt that, and in particular, I felt that around mind and body, this connection. So what happens when you meditate for a long time, at some point, you might have a bit of stability. So usually when we sit down to meditate, there's a lot of whirlwind of stuff. But sometimes we have a moment, or longer than a moment, of some stability. And when that happens, you might ask, what is my mind? So that's really what Hakuin is saying that you should do. How can I become awakened to my own mind? He says, Hakuin says, who is it that asks such a question? Is it your mind? Is it your original nature? Is it blue, yellow, red, or white? That's kind of good, actually. The blue, yellow, red, or white kind of brings things into the very concrete, you know, sort of into the body in a way. It's like, because we don't usually think of our mind. We have sort of an abstract idea of what the mind is, but he's asking this question, I don't think, to be flippant. It's more like, really, explore it. What is it? The other thing that can happen is, when you're in meditation, whether you're pondering the question of what is my mind, or whether you're just sitting with whatever practice you're doing, is a lot of times we can forget that we have a body, right? Have you ever experienced this? So, also an insight for me was when I realized when that happened, often my body, I was holding it very stiffly, like frozen, like tense. Not like super tense, but just, you know, we're told to sit perfectly still. And so sometimes we think that means rigid, and it's not actually rigid. Because to breathe, we need to move, our body needs to move. It moves very slightly, but it does actually move. So it's good to remember that you have a body when you're doing the practice, even if you're, or especially if you're asking the question of what is my mind. So Hakuin says, this it, this what is asking this question, it is something you must investigate and clarify for yourself. The what is asking this question, you must investigate and clarify for yourself. You must investigate it, whether you are standing or sitting, speaking or silent, when you are eating your rice or drinking tea. So again, this, what is it? What is that which you call your mind? The investigation part is not intellectual investigation. To investigate it, you need to be aware of your body. So that's kind of what, investigate it, whether you are standing or sitting, speaking or silent, eating your rice or drinking tea. So these are all like things of that the body is doing. So one way to think about this is, while you're doing all these things, now you're having this intellectual thing of, what is my mind, what is my mind? But I don't think that's what Hakuin is suggesting. I think it's more like, you investigate it through your standing, sitting, walking, through your eating, or whatever that you're doing. So to me, it's like, it's sort of like, this is what we're doing in Sesshin. We're paying attention to what we're doing, and we're seeing what that can open us to. So at each moment when we're sitting, paying attention to the sitting, and maybe there's a question of, what is this? And just letting it, that question be there without trying to, it's this. What is this? Eating. What is this? I mean, it can be even the food itself. What is this? Or what is this that I'm holding a bowl and bringing a spoon to my mouth? What is this? What is going on? Hakuin says, you must keep at it with total single-minded devotion. He says, and never, whatever you do, look in the sutras or commentaries for an answer, or seek it in the words you hear a teacher speak.
Could you
hear that? Yes. He says, you must keep at it with total single-minded devotion, and never, whatever you do, look in the sutras or commentaries for an answer, or seek it in the words you hear a teacher speak. So this is not to say never read sutras or commentaries or never listen to teachers. I mean, you could run out of here right now. You know, that would be one response. But it's a big caution. Don't seek for the answers in the sutras, commentaries, or even in something a teacher says. The answer can't be found there. So all of those things, the sutras, the commentaries, the words of a teacher, can point you in a direction. So it can be helpful that way. But Buddha is only to be found in your own body and mind. So the answer, and the answer of what is it? You can't get that answer from the sutras, commentaries, or a teacher. So then Hakuin kind of gives a little clue of, like, in case you despair, he says, when all the effort you can muster has been exhausted and you have reached a total impasse, it will suddenly come and you will break free. Now, Hakuin was a Rinzai master, so this is a very Rinzai kind of thing to say. Not that it's not true, but just to say the tone is a little different than what you might hear from Soto teachers. But I think it's pretty good. You know, I mean, in Rinzai, they talk a lot about the sudden nature of enlightenment. And of course it is sudden, but it's not always dramatic. So I think sometimes when we hear about sudden enlightenment, we think of really a lot of drama. And sometimes it's more like, This is something you hear at Soto Zen. It's more like you're walking for a long time in the midst of mist. You're walking for a long time in the mist, and suddenly you realize you're soaking wet. So that's the sudden that you hear about in Soto Zen, is more like that. Although sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's dramatic. It's not excluding the dramatic. But there is this thing of, you have to make a really big effort when all the effort you can muster has been exhausted. So, like, that's the thing, you know, really go at it with total single-minded devotion. So then there's something else. Well, actually, this is kind of, it's sort of a repeat of never look for it elsewhere. He says, even if no breakthrough occurs until your dying day, and you spend 20 or 30 years in vain without ever seeing into your true nature, I want your solemn pledge that you will never turn for spiritual support to those tales that you hear, the down and out old men and washed out old women peddling everywhere today. And as for your chances with the patriarchs difficult to pass koans, the less said about them the better, because they will be totally beyond your grasp. So for anyone who's done koan study, you might say, okay, yeah, I already know that they're totally beyond my grasp. So, but really, like I said, this is just another warning about don't seek for these answers outside yourself. So when he says the down and out old men and washed out old women, he's really referring to those who would offer to give you an answer. Like, here, I can tell you what the real truth of reality is. If you hear someone say that, watch out. Because a true teacher will help point you to your own Buddha nature. He also is kind of saying with the koans, if you're looking for answers in the koans, so those are the Zen stories of old, that actually in Rinzai Zen, they use that as, that's a method of meditation, is meditating with a particular koan. Like, you know, the famous in popular culture is, what is the sound of one hand clapping? So, I mean, people make fun of that, but in Rinzai Zen, it would be like sitting with that, walking with that, doing orioki with that, going to the toilet with that, you know, like all your waking moment would be consumed with, you know, just like asking this question over and over and seeing what comes. But sometimes people might get a false idea, like there's one answer, there's one like right answer, and I just need to find it. Like, let me look, is it in here? Did someone, you know, do the cheat sheet?
Yes.
Yeah, and some did. There's a book of koans called The Blue Cliff Record, and then there's another book called Secrets of the Blue Cliff Record, you know, as if the answers would be there. And I remember thinking when I was early in my study, I was, you know, like, oh, okay, let me look at that. It's like, whoa, actually, the answers are not there. The Secrets of the Blue Cliff Record is not really telling me the answer. It's really continuing to point in a direction that says, I have to look here. I'm not going to find the answers out there. Okay, so since we're not going to find the answers out there, Hakuin says, hence, a priest of former times, Cao Feng Yuan Miao, said, a person who commits himself to the practice of Zen must be equipped with three essentials: a great root of faith, a great ball of doubt, a great tenacity of purpose. Lacking any one of them, you are like a tripod with only two legs. Not going to stand up.
Can you read that again?
Yes. A person, this is Cao Feng Yuan Miao, a person who commits himself to the practice of Zen must be equipped with three essentials: a great root of faith, a great ball of doubt, a great tenacity of purpose. So what are these three? What is a great root of faith? So this is faith in the practice. Faith that it is possible for a person, even yourself, to completely let go of all attachments. This is faith in our own intrinsic Buddha nature. And if you feel like, I don't have a great root of faith, like my faith in that isn't very strong, it's said that one thing that you can do is study. Like, study the stories from the ancient teachers to see, oh, it was actually possible for them to let go. Or find teachers or even fellow students that are doing the practice in a wholehearted way and say, oh, you know, if it is possible for a human being like them to do the practice, then it is for me too. Like, I'm not outside of that. So that can be something you can do to cultivate your great root of faith. And even if it's not like completely strong, you can still go forward to say, like, with a little bit of a, well, maybe I can act as if, and then see if that great root of faith develops. So next we have a great ball of doubt. So you might think, oh yeah, I have that. But it's actually not exactly what you think. So the great ball of doubt does not refer to self-doubt. It's not doubt like, I doubt I could really do this practice. I really doubt in a big, great ball way. No. Actually, the great ball of doubt is that question of what is it? So it's like doubting. It's not taking for granted what we see right in front of us is all there is. That is the great ball of doubt. So that question of what is my mind? Or what is this? Or what is this feeling in my body? Or what is really going on here? So it's this great ball of doubt is wondering, is there more here than what meets the eye? Is there more here than what I have usually believed to be so? And for some people, it's hard to cultivate the great ball of doubt. Like especially people who are more scientific minded might have some, not always, but might have difficulty. It's like, okay, no, the evidence is here, so this is what it is. Rather than, well, are there things that I don't know? Are there things that are beyond my understanding? So then third we come to the great tenacity of purpose. So that this is the fire with which we want to engage our practice. So if we have a burning question, we can use that as fuel to stoke the flames of our great tenacity of purpose, how we can go forward. Hakuin goes on to say, thus it is said, okay, this is right after he says you need these three, or he quotes the other teacher saying you need these three, great root of faith, great ball of doubt, and great tenacity of purpose. Thus it is said that it takes three long kalpas for lazy and inattentive sentient beings to attain nirvana, while for the fearless and stout-hearted, Buddhahood comes in a single instant of thought. What you must do is concentrate single-mindedly on bringing all your native potential into play. I like that native potential, like you've got it in you. Just bring it into play. The practice of Zen is like making a fire by friction. The essential thing as you rub wood against stone is to apply continuous all-out effort. If you stop when you see the first sign of smoke, you will never get even a flicker of fire, even though you keep rubbing away for two or three kalpas. So I don't know how many of you have ever tried to start a fire rubbing two sticks together or rubbing, you know, on a stick on a flintstone. I've tried. I mean, it's really hard, and it takes a long time. I've also tried whipping cream by hand with a whisk instead of an electric mixer, and it's kind of the same thing. I mean, you just have to keep going and keep going. If you stop and then rest and then you have to keep going. So I used to think, when I heard instructions like this, I used to think it meant I should sleep when I'm dead. While I'm alive, I should devote myself wholeheartedly to Zen practice, losing sleep, not taking care of relationships, basically being a fanatic. So that's what I thought it meant. Like, okay, it seems to mean, say that. It's like, all right, you keep rubbing away. Don't stop. So I don't see it that way now. I mean, I see that continuous all out effort looks differently to me. It is still all out effort, but it includes rest and taking care of relationships. It includes the whole picture. So Thich Nhat Hanh, when he talks about the word effort, he says he prefers the word diligence to the word effort. And actually that is one other translation of the word effort from the from the past sutras where it wasn't in English. So the teachings on right effort, which is one of the Eightfold Path, or diligence, is that it includes mindfulness or interest. So effort includes some interest, joy, and rest. Those are included in effort. So if you're really interested in something, you keep going, right? I mean, think about things that you're interested in. If you're interested in something, you can do that activity and lose track of time. You know, you're really, because it's holding your attention. And also it's joyful then. You have some joy in doing it. You're happy, so you keep doing it. And then the rest part is resting so that you can keep doing it for the long term. So it's not the same as stopping the friction on the wood of the stone or stopping beating the cream. It's not collapsing. It's more like slowing down your rhythm so you can keep going. So this is an instruction also in how we can do sesshin. So when the bell rings at the end of a meditation period or end of a set of meditation periods, maybe it's time for the meal, so there's a transition, that's not the time to collapse or hide out. So often that's what happens. Like we're have a lot of effort when we're sitting there. And maybe, you know, we're distracted, but still, there's a certain effort, even just holding our body still. And then the bell rings. Oh. So we can let the exhale come. It's not like we have to get rid of that kind of joy, but then notice that, oh, okay, this is now what's happening. Now I'm feeling, I'm relaxing. That's curious. I wonder why I wasn't relaxing before. or now let me practice mindfulness and attention, interest, joy in this moment, which is looking different than the moment of sitting still. But it also, this having this continuous practice, concentrating single-mindedly, continuous all-out effort, also means that, like, especially within the sitting, we could say, because it's like a magnifying glass on what's going on. I mean, usually we can bring all this attention to eating, to walking around, to using the bathroom, getting a cup of tea, but there's so many other things going on that it's hard to actually really pay attention. But when we're just sitting there, there can be a lot going on in our mind and our thoughts, but there's just not a lot of externals going on. And that's partly why we usually have a zendo that doesn't have a lot of like pictures. We have some in this zendo, but there's not a lot of colors and other things, because it's a way to help sort of limit the stimuli that's usually coming at us. So now the stimuli is limited and we're just sitting there. So there might come a point in that sitting when things get really difficult. I shouldn't say might, there will. There will come a point. And what's difficult for you might be different of what's difficult for someone else, but we all have our own difficulties. And then when that comes up, how can we stay with it? How can we stay with it and not collapse in that or not against it, you know, which is that rigid, you know, when we notice, like when the bell rings, if we notice, okay, now then we know that while we were sitting, we were not completely being wholehearted because there was a part of us that was like gritting our teeth against it. Now, sometimes we're in a lot of physical pain or emotional pain. So there might be gritting teeth that happens. So we don't have to beat ourselves up if we notice that was going on. But it's just a question, like, can I be with this in a different way? Can I be with this with the effort of interest, joy, and rest within the sitting, within this, what looks like, you know, really intense, and it is intense, but it looks like could be rigid, but instead, can I actually receive what's going on in my meditation? Like, oh, I'm curious about it. I'm interested in it. It's sort of, if it's interesting, maybe it's even a little bit joyful, like to see, even if I'm seeing like some pattern that I really don't want to see, and it could be somewhat unpleasant, but like, wow, that I can see it. There could be some joy that comes there, like, oh, I can actually notice it, rather than have this acting in the background and sort of impelling me to do things and say things that maybe I regret later. Instead, like, oh, I could actually notice it. So there could be some joy with that. And then rest too. So the rest part within the zazen is where when you say, you're burning with that, you're really sticking with it, and then you feel like your interest, you're not so interested, and the joy doesn't really seem to be there. So then you could say, well, how can I actually rest with this? And maybe you have to shift and do loving kindness phrases for yourself as a way to rest within the zazen. So for those who aren't familiar, the loving kindness phrases are things like, may I be safe. May I be happy. May I be healthy, or may my body be joyful. And may I be at ease. So kind of wishing those things for oneself can be a way of, you know, so then I can go back to later. It doesn't even have to be in that meditation period. Maybe now for the rest of this meditation period, I'm just doing, not just, because loving kindness practice is huge, I'm doing wholeheartedly loving kindness practice for myself as a way to continue in my wholehearted effort. So here's another example that Hakuin gives about the effort to keep going. He says, suppose someone is bothered because they have never tasted seawater. So like, oh, I really, you know, and so that's sort of odd. Maybe you could say, I've never seen the ocean. He's saying tasted seawater. Maybe that's just a way of saying, I've never actually seen the ocean. To actually be able to taste the seawater, to be that close that I could taste it. So he says, they've never tasted seawater, and they decide to sample some. They set out in the direction of the sea, but before they have gone 100 paces, they stop and come back. They start out again, but this time they return after they have taken only 10 steps. They will never get to know the taste of the seawater that way, will they? But if they go straight ahead without turning back, even if they live far inland in a landlocked province such as, I don't know these provinces, Minnesota. But yeah, Minnesota, they will eventually reach the sea. By dipping their finger in the water and tasting it, they will know instantly the taste of the seawater the world over. Because it is, of course, the same everywhere, in India, China, the Southern Sea, or the Northern Sea, or the Atlantic Ocean, or the Pacific Ocean. So sometimes, for some of us, we may get too caught up in the idea of rest. So this probably isn't so much for people who are here in Sesshin, who might know that Zen involves effort. But there are a lot of people who think that Zen should be blissful and effortless, or even emotionless. Actually, I had a conversation last night with someone who So I just want to do a little mom brag, sorry. So this piece, that song, art song that my son wrote, which is vocal and piano, had a world premiere last night at Westminster Church. It's part of the Source Song Festival. And he set some poems of Ryokan, the Zen poet, to music. So anyway, and the singer was wonderful and very expressive. And afterwards, we were telling her, my husband Rob and I were telling her, oh, you sang wonderfully and you were so expressive. And she said, oh, I suppose that's not very Zen. Oh. We said, no, that is Zen. That is wholeheartedly participating. So anyway, so there might be some misunderstanding, like that Zen means like, yeah, I'm closing my eyes and I'm just blissing whatever is happening. And if it's too hard, that means I'm not actually doing it. It should be just super easy. So then we should ask ourselves the question, can I keep walking to the sea or will I keep turning back toward home? So now when I keep walking toward the sea, like if I'm in Minnesota and I was walking toward the sea, I think I would want to stop and sleep at night, right? I would want to stop and eat some food so I could keep walking. So it's not about that. It's not about not resting. It's just how how we orient ourselves. Can we orient ourselves facing the direction we want to go and keep going in that direction, not turning around? So Hakuin says, those Dharma patricians, I had to look up patricians, it's sort of this, like benefactors, like someone who like upholds and is taking care of things. It's a little different than practitioners. It's nice. Those Dharma patricians who explore the secret depths are like the people who keep walking to the sea. They go straight forward, boring into their own minds with unbroken effort, never letting up or retreating. Then the breakthrough suddenly comes. Again, Rinzai, suddenly comes. And with that, they penetrate their own nature. Oh, I like this part. And with that, they penetrate their own nature, the nature of others, the nature of sentient beings, the nature of the evil passions and of enlightenment, the nature of the Buddha nature, the God nature, the Bodhisattva nature, the sentient being nature, the non-sentient being nature, like mountains, the craving ghost nature, the contentious spirit nature, the beast nature. So those of you who know the six realms, that's referenced there. They are all of them seen in a single instant of thought. The great matter of their religious quest is completely and utterly resolved. There is nothing left. They are free of birth and death. What a thrilling moment it is.
That was as a result of continuing single-minded
effort. So they keep walking toward the sea. Mm-hmm. So I would say, yes, it is a thrilling moment, but also it's just a moment. In that moment, there's nothing left. In the next moment, it all comes back. Still, when it comes back, it has a different quality. So once you see the true nature of things, even a glimpse, nothing is ever the same. You can still forget and be deluded, but now you have a practice of letting go of delusion. You have a taste of what it is to let go of delusion. And you can start developing a habit of letting go of delusion. And actually, even now, that is what we are doing here, developing a habit of letting go of delusion. And that's what Zen practice, and especially Sesshin practice, is. It's designed to do that, and it is that. So we may have an idea about what is going on and what we are doing here, but we don't really know. And the forms, especially in Sishin, I think, encourage us to let go of our ideas and let go of the self. So like especially people who are in service positions say, oh no, it's not time to come out yet with the for the washing up water, or it's not time to, you know, whatever, come in the zendo or ring the bell or do this. And it's like, oh, I had an idea and now I can let go. So there's this practice, letting go. And we may think, I am not someone who naturally sits quietly, and yet here I am sitting. So like what we think we are and then what we're doing is clashing. So then that encourages us to let go of what we think we are. Or we might think, I don't know much about cooking. I've heard some tensos say that. Or ringing bells. I don't know much about ringing bells. I don't know much about chanting. And yet, whatever it is that we are doing, and then somehow we're doing it. I find myself cooking, ringing bells, chanting, or whatever. I remember one Tenzo, before he started his whatever term of service, Tenzo is a cook, he said, I think the first bowl will be the first bowl will be tomato soup, the second bowl will be Fritos, and the third bowl will be, you know, Twinkies. I don't know, it was something like that. Because he really didn't know how to cook. But he did it. And it wasn't Twinkies and Fritos. Okay. Hakuin says, it is with great respect and deep reverence that I urge all of you seekers who investigate the secret depths, to be as earnest in penetrating and clarifying the self as you would be putting out a fire on top of your head. So you wouldn't delay if there was a fire on top of your head. To be as assiduous in boring through your doubt as you would be seeking a lost article of incalculable worth. Cao Fang said, at the bottom of great doubt lies great enlightenment. A full measure of doubt will become a full measure of enlightenment. And again, this is the doubt of, like, what is it kind of doubt with regard to whatever's coming up. Can you really be present to the moment in the core of your being? And wondering, and that's what Hakuin is asking us to do. And in case you feel a yes but coming up, Hakuin has some more to say, and I might share this tomorrow on Sunday as well. I think it's pretty good. He says, don't think the commitments and pressing duties of secular life leave you no time to go about forming a ball of doubt. Don't think your mind is so crowded with confused thoughts that you would be incapable of devoting yourself single-mindedly to Zen practice. And then he gives this example. Suppose a man was in a busy marketplace, pushing his way down a narrow street in a dense crowd, and some gold coins happened to drop out of his pocket into the dirt. And this is probably a man who's like an ordinary person who is concerned about money. And maybe like this is all his worldly money, right? Everything. This is going to be his retirement or his food for the... Anyway, do you imagine he would just leave them there, forget about them, continue on his way because of where he was in this busy marketplace with the dirt? Do you think someone would leave the gold pieces behind because he was in a congested place or because they were in the dirt? Of course not. He would be down there pushing and shoving as much as he had to, frantically turning everything upside down with tears in his eyes. His mind wouldn't rest until he had recovered them. Yet what are a few pieces of gold set against the way of inconceivable being that exists within your own mind? Could a jewel of such worth be attained easily without effort? He doesn't answer, but I think his answer is no. Needs to be some effort. So, you know, a lot of people tell me that they really aren't good at meditating and their minds are too busy to really engage this practice fully. So I hear that a lot, but, you know, that's the way all of our minds are, really. I mean, some people maybe have, it's easier for them to steady their mind. Okay, fine. But most people, that's not true. And even the people who find it easy to steady their minds, they have their own issues. So if you're this person who feels like, I can't do it, I would ask you to ask the question of, am I really that person? When all these thoughts are coming up, what can I do about it? Well, the practice is to accept what is. So this is what is happening right now. All these thoughts are coming up. So as soon as we realize that we're lost in thought, we just come back to the object of our meditation. Breath, loving kindness, whatever it is that we're practicing with, we just come back. Or maybe it's just simple awareness of whatever arises, the shikantaza practice, whatever we're doing, we just come back. We don't waste any time over what a bad meditator we are. That doesn't matter. Please not waste any more time on that. That's not helpful. It's not helpful to evaluate. I mean, it's hard not to, because our minds are binary, so that it comes up. But we can just ask ourselves, can I let go of this? And then if we say, no, I can't, then we say, okay, I'm going to look at this now. I'm evaluating. This is what's going on. So then that can become the object of our meditation. All right, what's that like in my body? What's it like sitting here evaluating what's coming up? And, like I said, if you're someone who actually has a chance for your thoughts to slow down or disappear, you don't get stuck there either. So you don't start thinking, now I'm a good meditator. That's evaluation too, and that's not helpful. Instead, you keep practicing. Continue to concentrate your effort single-mindedly, aware of the breath, loving-kindness phrases, asking what is it, being aware, whatever you practice, you still keep going. And if it shifts, like let's say you're a busy mind person and now it shifts and suddenly it's open. Okay, great, let it shift, but then still, can you still maintain open awareness? Or if you're, let's say, there's no thoughts and you're sitting there in silent bliss and then a thought comes up, can you just be there with that in open awareness rather than saying, oh shit, now I'm thinking again. So I'm just, we're actually out of time, so I want to just say to close, let's just keep doing this practice all day long. I mean, we can do it longer than today, but we're together today. We have this support, so let's really try. See if you can let go of your usual way. So especially, as I said, during like the transition times or during work practice, you could say, well, can I just pause and see what's happening here rather than, I mean, our usual way, I think, is to, I want to know, like, what's going on. So I ask a question, like, are we supposed to stand behind our cushions or in front? Are we supposed to, you know, is now this, you know, or where is this? Or, you know, so sometimes it's okay, especially during work practice, to ask a question. But rather than going to the habitual, just, we could just pause for a moment and say, okay. Maybe I know, now I see what the next thing is. Or maybe we pause for a moment and are just with our discomfort. And then we go and find that, you know, or someone that can help us and ask the question. But we don't, you know, maybe we can just practice being with what is arising. And then also when we're sitting and when we're doing zazen, being with what is arising. And I would like to say, just as a form suggestion, so I tell people when I'm doing teaching beginning meditation, you know, sit perfectly still, but if you need to shift your posture, please do. Because beginner meditators, they don't know yet, like, what is going to be the good posture for me. So I, you know, cut them a lot of slack. But we should try to find a position we can sit in where we can be still the entire period. Now, sometimes you need, you know, so, okay, sometimes you get in trouble. You're sitting and then suddenly there's something intense that's too, in pain, that's too intense to stay with for the remaining 5 or 10 minutes. So, okay, no one's going to beat you up if you move. But see if you can ask yourself, well, is this a position I can stay still in? Or maybe I switch to a chair or switch to a different position at the beginning of the meditation period if I think that I need a break because it's too hard on my body. And, you know, there also is the idea that, you know, sitting with pain for a little while is okay. You know, we can, you know, you're not going to probably hurt yourself if you have some pain, even intense pain, for 5 or 10 minutes and you sit with it. Now, if you turn around and the next meditation period you sit in the exact same posture that caused you that intense pain, that's maybe where it's not such a good idea. Because if you do that over and over, then you can cause permanent or semi-permanent damage and some nerve damage. Anyway, it's just a suggestion because there's something that's to actually staying still and not moving that can help you develop stability in your mind. So, although to get there, sometimes the mind is really fighting it, like, I can't possibly sit still for another second. So then you can see that's going on and like, that's interesting. And then you could say, what is really happening in my body? Can I really experience it instead of trying to shut it out? And, you know, if your answer is no, okay, you know, change posture. Like I said, I'm not going to hit you with a stick. But it's for your own benefit that I'm pointing you in the direction of see if you can be still. Okay? All right. Sorry for going a little bit over the time. Thank you so much for your practice.